like normal. All right, so this is apologetics session number 14, and we're finishing up the resurrection outline. We're actually on page 35. And what we'll do here is we'll just do these last five pages, and then we're going to move into our next topic and a new outline, which is archaeology and archaeological evidence, which further confirms the reliability of the Bible and the truth of the scriptures. But let's finish up the resurrection stuff. Did anybody read through this like I suggested last time? If not, it's okay. We're going to go through it now. So, okay, cool. So you'll know what's going on here. So on page 35, I have in the middle of this page item C, the other non-minimal circumstantial indirect evidence supporting both approaches above. And what I'd like you to do is just bear with me here, but there's a mistake on this page. Item C really should be at the top of the page, and all that stuff right up there, Roman numeral 8 down to Roman numeral 12, that should be under item C. So if you draw an arrow, that goes up on the top. And the subpoint, or the first subpoint, if you see down there it says a modified doctrine of resurrection developed rapidly, that actually is going to be point 3. So I'm going to give you two additional points before that point. And the first one is, above all of this stuff at the top of the page, the first item says all scholars attest to the fact, da-da-da-da. Up above that should be the first point, which all these subpoints flow under. And the first one says, the disciples preached the resurrection. Okay, so if you write that up on top of this chunk up here, point 1, or Roman numeral I, is the disciples preached the resurrection. Okay? And then all those subpoints make sense. And then the next point we'll get to is point 2, which you could put under all of this, is Jesus' tomb was not venerated. And then item 3 is that a modified resurrection developed rapidly. Okay? And then this will make sense. Kristen, hi. Do you want a handout of what this stuff is? Just for tonight? Okay. Just take a second here. Oh, sorry. Here it is. Okay, so we're on page 35. Okay, so the first point is the disciples preached the resurrection. This is up at the top, and all these subpoints are under that. So the disciples preached the resurrection. So this is a well-attested fact that essentially no one denies, scholars or popular critic. The reason why they don't deny it is because we know that's what they did, and there's no reason to reject it. We know that Christianity started, and the disciples started preaching a message, and then Christianity spread. So the idea here is that points to an origin, that points to a starting point. So first point is all scholars attest to the fact that the resurrection was spread. It was the point, not just a point, of preaching in the early church. And it was proclaimed in Jerusalem, where Jesus died and was buried shortly before. So the reason why this is important, next item, is if anyone questioned their testimony, they were around to back it up and check the facts with the other eyewitnesses. Meaning that because it happened in Jerusalem, there's people around that knew it happened, and they were well aware of the facts, and they could talk to them to verify this story against what these other people were had knowledge of. And so the resurrection message was the point of the early preaching. So it wasn't just a point, it was the point. So the idea was that the disciples didn't just go around saying that Jesus was a great teacher or Jesus was God. No, they went around saying that he resurrected. And this was the message. And this was what was the most powerful thing for the hearers of that time to hear. Not that he was God, not that he was the Messiah, but that he resurrected. That was the most important thing that the disciples preached and had the biggest impact. So that's why they stuck with it. So additionally, the first speech in Acts, when Peter preached to the people there right after Pentecost, that's also in the very city of Jerusalem where Jesus was killed. So there were eyewitnesses nearby who would have known what just took place 50 days before on Passover. So this is very, very important that this message started in Jerusalem, it spread from there, and this is exactly where Jesus was killed and was buried, all in the same vicinity. Now, if this message started, say, in England for some reason, and they kept talking about how Jesus resurrected in Jerusalem and was just killed 50 days before, well, there would be no one in England around to verify or falsify this claim. So in this case, it's a stronger point. When you make this point to the unbeliever, it holds weight because they're doing this all in the same place. So likewise, if the tomb wasn't empty, no movement could have been founded because the body would have been pointed to. But there was no body in the tomb, which explains the movement arising. So if Jesus was still dead right down the street, say a few hundred yards away is what scholars predict is how close the tomb was. If Jesus was still dead over there and they came out of their upper room on Pentecost and started preaching and someone says, hey, hold on a minute, wait here, I'm going to be right back, and they cart out Jesus' body, well, the movement would have stopped immediately. But that's not what happened. So if their report of what took place was a lie, then Christianity would not have succeeded in Jerusalem, but it did. So this is important, that it succeeded in Jerusalem, and not in England, not in India. It was right where it all went down. And it could have been easily rejected, could have been easily denied by the critics, especially the Jews, the Pharisees, and the like, who wanted to crush the movement. But they didn't cart out Jesus' body from the tomb. Now, the second point, like I said before, the one that says a modified doctrine of the resurrection developed rapidly, is this is an interesting point. Jesus' tomb was not venerated. Okay, it's not there. Just write it in. Item 2. Jesus' tomb was not venerated. What that means is, in that time, when certain special people died, they would go to the burial site and not just put flowers on it like we do today. They would create a shrine, basically, and go there kind of on pilgrimage to pay homage to the person who passed. So when you had a prophet of some sort, or very wise sage, or a respected governor, that grave would have been venerated. It would have been enshrined, essentially. What we don't have is evidence of any enshrinement. Now, Jesus would have definitely been worthy of such an honor, because he was a wise sage, because he was a prophet, because he was a good man. And so, all things equal, by comparison, Jesus definitely would have had his tomb also venerated. But we don't have veneration going on. And so what this suggests is that the body wasn't in there. And there was no reason for a pilgrimage to happen. There was no reason for a flowers and enshrinement to take place there, because there's nothing happening there. There's no dead body decaying there. So this is a point you can make. Again, these are, what I'm giving you is, like this thing says, other non-minimal circumstantial indirect evidence supporting the approaches above. The approaches being Gary Habermas's approach and William Lane Craig's and N.T. Wright's approach that we've been talking about. We looked at 12 facts, and then we looked at how Gary Habermas creates 5 facts that he says 75% of scholars, which equals 2,000 German, French, English over the last 30 years, have concurred that these 5 points, again, this is 2 pages back, these 5 points support the resurrection, and when you put them all together, it explains the resurrection and no other theory, no other alternative theory holds water, if you recall this. And then we looked at William Lane Craig and N.T. Wright's approach. And I told you they use a one-fact approach. And while we're talking about it, if you just flip the page back, I want to make another correction. I wouldn't now say they use one fact. I'm going to say they actually use 3 facts. So I went from 12 to Five by Gary Habermas, and then William Lane Craig at NT Wright's Three Facts approach you can put up there. Change the one to three. Now, I put the fact is they believed on your notes. Well, that is one of the three. The other two is there's an empty tomb and appearances. And the reason why I didn't have that in there the first time is because they kind of, NT Wright especially, has they believed, they have the resurrection and the empty tomb kind of in that fact. So it's kind of already embraced. And what I would like to do just to clarify, because I don't want them to think I'm using their stuff out of context or incorrectly, it makes it a lot more easier on me and them if I just tell you the three. The empty tomb, number one, the resurrection appearances, number two, and they believed, which means the disciples believed that he did rise from the grave. So when you have these three, what explains the resurrection is the only theory that accounts for these facts appropriately. And so, the number one, the empty tomb. Number two, the resurrection appearances. And number three, they believed. And so this three-fact approach, if you can remember nothing else and you can only remember three things, these three things are very well attested, and most, if not all, scholars concur with this. Now, Gary Habermas, again, he has the five-fact approach, and you could go back on page 33 and see Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and appeared to them. Conversion of the persecutor Paul, conversion of the skeptic James, and the tomb was found empty. So he doesn't include fact three that Craig has, which is the origin of the disciples' belief, or they believed, but he includes a few others. So you can go at it at different ways. You could have three, five, or 12. It doesn't matter. All create a compelling case that the resurrection is the only thing that makes sense. It has the most explanatory power, the most explanatory scope, and it's not ad hoc, and so forth. So there's multiple ways to test these things, and when you do that, they all succeed. So item three is now a modified doctrine of the resurrection. Okay, so a modified doctrine of the resurrection. So we've talked about this a little bit, so I'll go quickly over it. The Jewish conception of the resurrection was to be eschatological, meaning end times related, and non-individual, meaning it was to be a corporate body, bodily resurrection of all the righteous. That's what the Jews thought would happen at the end of the world. All the righteous will rise, and it would be a corporate bodily thing, like all of us, not just one person, and it will happen at the end. So so when Jesus comes alive, it was completely unexpected, because he rose on his own from the grave, and that was against their theology. So, item two, the multiple resurrection passages of the New Testament obviously reveal a radically modified theology of the primitive early church. They believe despite holding every previous position to the contrary. Meaning that when you read the New Testament, you read a theology of a resurrection that is unlike the Jewish theology of the resurrection. So what explains the modified resurrection theology from Jewishness to Christianness, if you will? So how do you explain this transition in theology? Why did it transition? And so item three, that Jesus was dead, and the Jews had no anticipation of a dying, much less rising Messiah. This is a sentence fragment, but the idea is that they did not expect a Messiah to actually resurrect, right? They expected the Messiah to conquer their oppressors, to lead them politically in a military struggle out of oppression. And the Messiah was well talked about in Jesus' time, because you have to remember that when Greece came in after the Babylonian exile, the 400 years of silence, as evangelicals say, 400 BC to Jesus, basically, you have a lot of talk about the Messiah, because you have the desecration of the temple by some of the Greek military commanders that happened during the time of I can't think of his name. It'll come to me later. And there's this Jewish struggle that was happening before the Romans came in. And so there's this long-awaited hope that was yet to be fulfilled. So this talk about the Messiah was all around. But nowhere in the Old Testament do you see anything about a Messiah is one who will resurrect after he dies. There's nothing like that there. So according to Jewish law, Jesus, next page, execution as a criminal showed him out to be a heretic, a man literally under the curse of God. So when he was sentenced as a criminal, basically sent to the execution, electric chair, gas chamber, so to speak, this would shame the disciples. And in that culture, an honor-shame culture, much different than our culture, this was devastating. So their name was associated now with this criminal. And so moreover, Jesus' Jewish belief about the afterlife precluded anyone's rising from the dead before the general eschatological resurrection of the dead. I mentioned that already. And thus the disciples' belief cannot be explained in terms of an antecedent Jewish resurrected theology. So the question naturally arises, why did the theology change from Jewish theology to Christian theology? Okay, so this point is a good one. So you have three points now that are circumstantial, indirect, if you will, that further support all the other facts that we presented. And these facts are also not in question by scholars, not in question by popular critics. These facts are historically accurate, and they're neutral facts. They're just basic things. There's no supernatural anything here. There's no Jesus rose from the grave or Jesus fed 5,000. They're just facts of history. You have a modified resurrection theology. You see that in Paul. Whether Paul was crazy or not, it's still a modified resurrection theology. You have no veneration at the tomb and so forth. So again, these are just basic neutral facts, but when you put them together, the case goes from 50.1% belief beyond more probable than not level to the 90% level, which is beyond reasonable doubt, when you put these next to the minimal facts that we talked about. Your certainty level rises. Item 4, you could cross out 2 and just put item 4, Jewish converts turning to new practices embracing social changes. So you have a bunch of Jews who were all about traditions and laws and old religion. That was well attested. We see a strong Jewish lifestyle and social life in Jerusalem and around the surrounding area. They kept to it because of the Babylonian exile, because of the conquering of Assyria, because of the Greeks, because of the Roman invaders. They kept to their practices and their traditions and their rituals. They held to it tightly because what it did was it reminded them of the past. It reminded them of Moses bringing them out of Egypt and all these things, all the Sabbath days and the Jewish holy days. These things were there because they had a calling to the heart that would cause the Jewish person to move towards the Lord with a sense of love and respect. And much like is what we try to do today with our church service, with worship and preaching, it's to move the heart. It's a liturgy, if you will, that draws the heart towards the Lord in a loving manner. And so this was powerful. It was much a part of their social life. And so we see a social earthquake where 10,000 Jews abandoned centuries of practice of all these rituals within 5 weeks of Jesus' death. Again, from Passover to Pentecost, right at Pentecost, there's an earthquake that took place. What was the epicenter of this quake? We have to ask ourselves, why did all these Jews suddenly stop doing the rituals that were so important to them, so important to their identity, and how they related to the Lord, Yahweh? All of a sudden came to a halt, and Sunday then became a primary day of worship, and they started taking the Eucharist. They started breaking the bread and drinking the wine in remembrance of him, sharing belongings, we see in Act. There's a bunch of other things I could list here about how the social system changed for the early Christians, the first Christians. So again, this is just a historical fact. These things took place. A point here, item 5, cross out 3. Strong emergence of the underground church. So the church endured persecution and grew due to its core message that Jesus rose from the grave. So it emerged and it was underground. It was kind of in secret. They weren't worshiping Rome, the Roman gods. They weren't worshiping Caesar and calling Caesar Lord. So they had to be underground, essentially. Kind of like China. And what has happened in China over the last 50 years? The church has grown exponentially. The same thing was happening here. All within homes, if you will, all underground. In light of the brutal circumstances its followers faced, the successful expansion of Christianity is remarkable and uncanny. It's crazy how such a thing spreads like this. There's nothing like it in the world than the advance of the kingdom of God in the hearts and minds of his followers. This appeals to any historian as a significant persevering movement, which had to be founded on a life-changing, monumental event. What was it that took place that caused such an expansion, such a radical, exponential growth? What sort of thing could have took place? In light of this major shift, there is no other alternative hypothesis or explanation that is plausible, contains any explanatory power and scope, or appropriately fits the available data of post-AD 30 than the fact that the bodily resurrected Jesus of Nazareth appeared to his disciples. So the Roman Empire was radically changed by the conversion of Emperor Constantine later on, and Western civilization later on became completely shaped by the Christian faith. To paraphrase that. So the idea here is that if you have Trayvon Martin getting killed in Florida and you have outbreak all over the United States in the last few weeks, what was it? What was the thing that caused such an outcry? It was an event. Someone was killed in an unjust manner. And we can see that there is an origin of such a thing. And so what we're saying is this movement that spread had an origin. And so we're saying Jesus' resurrected body was the origin. And lastly, the disciples died for their beliefs. So this would be item 6. So the eyewitnesses of the resurrection, the resurrected Jesus, went to their deaths not in virtue of their unwillingness to die, but inability to deny the bodily resurrection. How could they deny what they knew to be true? So this is the point we made a couple weeks ago when we saw a British critic, historian, I think her name was Lucy Grigg, earlier in the notes, claiming that the disciples lied because they wanted power and position in the early church. Do you remember that? They sought to have fame. They sought to have a strong identity. They wanted to become somebody, especially after a devastating loss. They thought they could use that for their own gain and cause themselves to be a person of importance and go down in history as someone who started a great religion. And so she makes this assertion that this was a bad motivation on the part of the disciples. And so what we're saying here and what she's saying is they could have denied it, but they didn't. They knew it wasn't true, and they could have said, yeah, you're right, Mr. Torturer. You can stop whipping me now. I'll confess I made it up, which never happened. Why didn't it happen? Because it wasn't that they were unwilling to deny the resurrection, but they couldn't deny it. They could not lie. They could not say, you're right, I never saw Jesus raised, risen body. They had to hold to what they actually knew to be true. It was undeniable for the disciples. This is a big point. It wasn't that they were unwilling. It was undeniable. They had an inability to deny the resurrection. So the actual, I don't know why it goes from 5 to 1. Sorry about that. The actual seeing of the body, the bodily resurrected Jesus, caused the belief. And the Jesus they ate with at the Last Supper was the same Jesus they ate with on the beach after he rose from the grave. Okay, so this is important. They knew it was the same guy in both cases. It wasn't a twin. It wasn't an alien. It was neither of those things. The disciples were transformed from doubters to bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. And after a couple disciples died, they realized the hardships, persecutions, and executions were coming if they didn't deny the resurrection. So say you have two martyrs, Stephen, we see in Acts, and say the next guy. James, I think, was martyred in like AD 50 or something. So once disciples started seeing, okay, my buddy just got killed, do we really want to keep going on with this thing? You know, let's get off this boat. It's sinking. But they did. They realized the hardships. They realized the persecutions. They realized that they were going to be executed if they didn't deny the resurrection. But they pressed on regardless. Paul was thrown in prison, but he kept preaching. They stoned him in, I think it was Ephesus, and they threw him out of the city, and then he comes back and preaches again. So it was expected, despite Paul's chains, he still wrote. It was a continued honor then. This is interesting because it wasn't just a modified resurrection theology that we just saw that developed. It was now something personal. Like, I will die for the sake of Jesus. I embrace this theology to a point where it's transformed me, and now I will give my life for it. It became now a decision. Not only is this true, but I'm going to do everything I can to prove it. So this was a powerful statement to make in the face of their torturers. They were ridiculed, beaten, imprisoned, tortured, eaten alive, burned to death, beheaded, crucified, stoned, etc. And again, like we've talked about, people will die for their religious beliefs if they sincerely believe they're true, but people won't die for their religious beliefs if they know their beliefs are false. And we've talked about that before, right? So no one's going to be tortured and killed when they know something they're being killed for is a lie. They'll just confess it and get out of it. They would not have died for knowing this. They would not have died for this, knowing that they raided the tomb and stole the body. Think of it. If the disciples overtook the guard somehow, pulled Jesus out of the body, dead, and moved him to Galilee and tossed him in the sea, and then went on to preach this, it doesn't make any sense. That theory doesn't make sense. They would not have died knowing that they lied to make sense of Jesus' life. Well, they followed this guy around for 3 years. He preached all kinds of crazy stuff about the kingdom of God and talked in parables. And he said he was the Messiah and the Son of Man and the Son of God. He talked about the Father. And so we need to just kind of make this lie up. That theory doesn't make sense either, that they made the lie up to make sense of Jesus' strange or weird life. They would not have died knowing that the beaten and bruised Jesus was just resuscitated. So say Jesus never actually died, but he just got up from a coma, and they kind of helped him and nursed him back into shape. And then he went on to marry Mary Magdalene. They would not have died and been beaten knowing that Jesus just woke up from a coma. They would not have continued this message to their deaths in the face of hunger and torture and all these hardships if Jesus was just resuscitated. So J.P. Moreland says, the disciples were able to see with their own eyes, touch with their own hands. They were in a unique position, not just to believe Jesus rose from the dead, but to know for sure. They had nothing to gain and everything to lose. So we have to remember that when Paul was put in prison, he wasn't well fed. His feces were probably over there in the corner. He was probably losing a lot of weight and probably got sick a lot, because there's not a lot of medical attention you get when you're in a jail cell. The conditions of the time were severe and harsh, and it wasn't just like, all right, you know, I'm going to live in Irvine, and then when it's time to get martyred in 3 years from now, I'll do it. I'll jump off the pier, tie myself to a weight, and just drown. You know, it wasn't a nice lifestyle like we have today. It was terrible. Malnourished, sick, disease-ridden, all that. If they weren't absolutely certain, Lee Strobel says, they wouldn't have allowed themselves to be tortured to death for proclaiming that the resurrection happened. They were completely, completely certain that this took place. If they didn't have a high certainty level, they wouldn't have went through with this. What did Thomas say, doubting Thomas? Behold, my Lord and my God, when he was so skeptical before. You can skip point 8. Point 9, philosopher and theologian Daniel Kendall says, nevertheless, the testimony of the authoritative bearers of the tradition, which are us, is at least rooted in the once and for all experience of the original disciples who encountered Jesus historically. So in this sense, Kendall is right. We believe because they knew for sure. So our certainty meter is somehow connected to their certainty meter. And how did they prove it, that they were so certain that this happened? How did they tell all future civilizations, all future peoples? They told us through their death. They said, I'm stamping, certifying this with my mark of approval, my life. I can't put a rubber stamp notary. I can't put my professional engineer stamp on some drawings. I can't put that on this gospel I'm writing, but I will give you the stamp of my life so you will know a certainty, as best as I can convince you, that Jesus actually rose. So, item 10, next page, Kendall is right. The martyrdom of the eyewitnesses serves as compelling evidence what was testified in the New Testament and what was preached by them throughout the Roman Empire during the first century actually occurred in history. Just the martyrdom of the disciples is then all we need to establish a connection between the belief in the resurrection and its truth. And so what we're saying here is this one point is circumstantial. It's indirect evidence. It's something that just adds to the pile of evidence that we already have. But it is powerful. When you throw this in as the last one, it's a moving piece of evidence. And it works well when you put it at the end like I did, because it's just a powerful point. Are you willing to accept this, and are you willing to die for it? And Jesus essentially called us to that. He said, lay down your life. And he talked about losing it all for the kingdom. And so it's interesting that's exactly what his disciples did in a literal way. And we do that figuratively now, especially in Orange County. So this is a powerful point. So thus, we see that the evidence provides a compelling case for a historical resurrection event, which is the theory with the most explanatory power and scope. And so the case is now made. And in conclusion, we can be confident and have certainty that Jesus lived, he died, and he resurrected. Now, all of this biblical apologetics, this whole module, has been building up to certify these three statements. He existed, he died, and he resurrected. We didn't talk about his teaching and all these things, although those are important, but it's all forming a case that this main chunk right here, Jesus lived, died, and resurrected, is true. So if we can say that Jesus lived, died, and resurrected, what do we get from that? We get God's existence. Because the only thing that could have raised Jesus from the dead is an all-powerful God. Then what also do we get? We get a person like Jesus who is essentially saying, God is who I represent. When you see me, you see the Father. And so then we understand who God is through the person of Jesus. So all of the Christian truth claims that come from Paul are kind of based on the idea of Jesus being God and Jesus resurrected. All of Christianity, most of Christianity, we learn from Paul. Paul taught so much. And what happened to Paul? He was radically converted by the appearance of Jesus on the Damascus Road. And he further confirmed that with the disciples on his subsequent trip to Jerusalem within 3 years. When he talked to them about it, hey, what do you know about Jesus? He appeared to me on the road. It's life-changing. And so it's all about this. It's all about Jesus. So the philosophical apologetics module, scientific apologetics module, All of those create a powerful and compelling case for God, as we will see in the future. But this is the best, I think, the biblical apologetic stuff. It creates the best case because it's historical. These things are almost undeniable. And you easily get God when you get Jesus. So if you can prove these things about Jesus, that he lived, died, and resurrected, and of course, what he taught and what he said, all that stuff, then you easily get God. So all you really got to get to, if you can make it your goal in conversation with someone, maybe it takes months to do this, if you could get to the goal of getting them to the resurrection, it's probably the best thing to do. Because it's easy to debate the philosophy about God's existence all day long, all your life long, but this stuff is so straightforward, you have to say yes or no, reject it or accept it. And when, like I've talked about in the past, we want to tear down the walls of unbelief so that someone could come face to face with Jesus. And there's no way better to do it than this. What do you think about this guy? And then let them decide. And hopefully, as they ponder Jesus and as they get connected with what he said and taught, they'll be compelled to believe in him anyway, because he's such a compelling figure when you read the Gospels, and especially the rest of the New Testament. Any questions? So the next page in this little part right here is kind of implications, how it matters to us as Christians, and essentially non-Christians too, for that matter. So real quick, and then we'll go to break. We'll just skim through this. Is the resurrection a watertight deductive proof? No, but it's powerfully compelling. It's a powerfully compelling inductive argument. And N.T. Wright, he points out that the resurrection is similar to examples of big legal historical cases, and the evidence in his perspective obviously points to a blindingly obvious solution. So he's saying, look, there's no way to reject this and be rational. So I'm going on and on here about the approach that you take as a legal person and so forth. But if you skip down to the next page, item E, a non-objecting common belief of the early church is that of post-Enlightenment thought of today, that dead people don't rise. See, we have to understand that the disciples also thought dead people don't rise. The Jews also thought dead people don't rise, unless it's the end of the world. And that's what we have today in our post-Enlightenment culture. Dead people don't rise. We say it all the time. Miracles don't happen. We talk about that all the time in our culture. So the true historical challenge of one's worldview is how it handles the relationship between death and life and God's existence. So Buddhism, Hinduism, Mormonism, all these things needs to have a good understanding, theology, philosophy on death and life and God. And if that worldview, and say you're just a secular atheist, non-Christian, your worldview needs to figure out death, life, and God. And if it can't, it needs to be rejected. And so death, life, and God is extremely important in one's overall thought process and how he lives his life. So William Lane Craig discusses the presuppositions of modern historians and their method, and that the story is historically verifiable and falsifiable. So we're not just talking about God in an ethereal manner, some abstract sense. We're talking about something that actually took place on this planet 2,000 years ago, at a set time ago, that's verifiable and falsifiable. We can say, no, this didn't happen because of these reasons. We can falsify it. You can't falsify certain claims by other worldviews or religions that the cow is a god. You can't falsify that. It's impossible. That parallel universes exist concurrently. You can't falsify that. But we can falsify these historical evidences. We can say Jesus never died and Christianity should be rejected, or Jesus never died and rose again, or Jesus died and rose again, and so Christianity ought to be accepted. So this is a striking point for the reader and skeptic, and Craig does it with a very credible authority. where the denial of the resurrection isn't due to a lack of evidential data or satisfaction of criteria, but is an a priori rational choice. A priori is a technical philosophical term that means before evidence, before empirical findings, before test and data. One is making a predisposed decision. One is already has a predisposition to choose this because it's part of his understanding of the world, his worldview. So he automatically chooses this despite the data available to him. So most of the time, Craig says, people deny the resurrection not because of the evidence, but because of their a priori rational choice. It's a worldview issue, William Lane Craig says, who's been debating this and writing on this topic for 30 years. The laws of nature do not disallow any events. This is important, but are simply descriptions of how things usually occur. Miracles are possible. So science, people think of as being set in stone. It's fact that gravity is here, and you can't deny that. Well, that's not exactly true. The law of gravity just says that this is how it's always happened in the past, and until it continues to happen otherwise, we're going to call this thing gravity. It's a law that we're putting the term law on it because it never ceases to stop doing this. But what happens is a miracle is the cessation of natural laws. So once that process discontinues, we call that a miracle. So science is saying that's impossible because a law never stops. But that's not really true with science. The skeptic of Christianity will say science says that laws cannot allow miracles, but that's a worldview called scientism. But in reality, science says that these things continue to do their thing until something else happens. And so what we're saying is miracles is the time in which that thing stops and something else comes into effect. So the resurrection is a self-involving issue and matters globally. It's not just something you read and you're like, okay, cool, later, and you walk away. It's a self-involving issue like nothing else is. When you read the existentialist philosophers, they're talking about death and life. And they've talked about this throughout the last 100 years or so. People say, well, the existentialist movement is dead. It just, in my opinion, morphed into something we call postmodernism. But the interesting thing is that this is really where philosophy, history, theology all come together. It's this crucial point about death and life. Once you start saying that someone rose from the grave and he's going to allow you to do the same thing, everything changes. It's a self-involving issue. Christian or non-Christian, this is what it's all about. When you think about your job, the stress you have, and everything, family issues, trauma, abuse, all the injustice in the world, once you have a resurrection and the hope that we can attain the same thing, it matters to us. It should change us. It should change our perspective to the point where we at least want to investigate it, if not want to make a life-changing decision about it. So here's an interesting thing. When you get to Jesus, not only is he compelling, but then you're offering hope to the unbeliever, the non-Christian. You're saying, you can be risen from the grave. When you die, you don't have to stay dead. You can continue to live in a way that's far better than this. So it's a self-involving issue and matters globally. The resurrection powerfully matters and affects one's worldview. It is not a thing of minimal personal involvement, but a self-involving. So once you hear about it, it ought to be impactful, and it ought to, you know, be a hook to the listener. So I want to encourage you to get to this place, if at all possible. If you have to take shortcuts through all this material in a conversation, get to it, because it hooks people, especially when they understand that they can have it too. We don't have to just die and suffer and it's all meaningless, as the existentialist philosophers say. No, there's hope to our suffering now, because one day it will all be made right because of the resurrection. And then I'm saying, moreover, not only in personal thought, like in our individual introspection, but global thought, the resurrection has deep epistemological implications on culture, society, and philosophy. The resurrection is the key to powerfully unlocking modern epistemology, meaning that because we live in a post-enlightenment world, post-modernism world, we have epistemological biases. We have epistemological needs. We need things proven to us in ways that are unlike never before, or like never before. So we have to have such a high level of certainty in our world to say that we have knowledge of something. In the past, it hasn't always been like this. And so what I'm saying here is that when you have the resurrection, it's unlocking our distorted epistemology that we have today. It's the key to take away all the humanism that we've attached to ourselves as a culture. We can reject it and say, no, there's some truth out there, and I can stand firm on that, and I can even say I know it. And so when that happens, and especially when it's, in this sense, a miracle, every worldview, every world religion now has to deal with this, has to beat this, if you will. Because other than that, we're all going to continue to move through the academic ivory tower systems of thought from one generation to another. Everyone's looking for truth. Everyone's understanding, how could I know something to be true? Their epistemology is flawed. It's faulted because we're humans. We have a faulty perspective. We're born with that. It's our part of our sinful nature. So the early church, interestingly enough, explained the aggregate of evidence much better than modern, sophisticated skepticism. So we must confront post-enlightenment skepticism by turning the historical argument against the skeptics. And the historical challenge must be faced, and people must face the implications. So when they come to the truth of who Jesus was and that he rose from the grave, there's implications for them personally. It matters. What remains after further inquiry of all the alternatives is that no other rival theory adequately compares to the explanatory power of the resurrection theory. So it's not just intellectual, but it's profoundly impactful for not only us as Christians today, it continues to impact us as we live the Christian life, but the resurrection impacts the non-Christian in ways they may not have even grasped yet. So this is why I think this is my favorite topic in all of apologetics, is because it matters. It matters, and you can't just reject it as intellectual, academic fluff. Questions? So the Passover service from the humanistic Jews, I mean, they beat God out of the Exodus. I mean, you know, they, and it's so amazing. They don't have God anywhere in it. He was mentioned four times in the whole service. This wasn't at a Seder dinner, was it?
No, I'm working for a 9-year-old Jewish lady who went to two humanistic Passovers, and she was like, throw them out. I said, if I have them, I want to read them.
Cool. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of humanistic religious people, if you can think of it that way. Especially in Judaism.
But the believing Jews, the religious Jews, do have this. Yeah. So most cultural Jews are atheists.
Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I had somebody, I
Yeah.
And like went into the city. And
yeah. Extremely strange.
Use it as like an example of like, you know, see how absurd Christianity is, kind of thing. I thought it was really interesting.
What did you say?
I didn't say anything. I just went, huh.
And it just moves on after that. It's very awkward, and it doesn't appear in any of the other Gospels. It's very strange. I don't think so. I think he's trying to describe something literal. But, like, you see the dead bodies walking around. I don't know if it's Mark. It may be another one. Maybe Luke or something. Maybe Matthew. I'm not sure. Okay, maybe it was Mark, but... it is extremely interesting, and when you read commentaries, the commentators are usually confused. So how do we explain that? I don't know, and a lot of other smart dudes don't know either. So what do I say to that? I say, well, it's not contradicting anything we know about the rest of the Gospels or Jesus. I don't think so. I don't think it's in that part. Yeah, if maybe you could borrow somebody's Bible and... Yeah, and I used to think it said there were kind of ghosts that kind of hung out in Jerusalem. Like, yeah. But I think it's actually dead people rose from the grave when Jesus rose. It says other dead people were seen in Jerusalem at that time or something like that.
The graves were open. And
yeah.
I don't find it marked.
But I know what you're talking about. And it's a very strange thing, probably one of the strangest things in the Bible. But again, it doesn't contradict anything we know about Jesus or the resurrection, Paul's theology, even Revelation. I mean, nothing, it's weird, but it doesn't contradict anything. We see super weird stuff in the Old Testament, too. We see bears attacking boys because Elijah's being, you know, picked on by them. We see the earth swallowing up a bunch of people that were being disobedient to God. And weird stuff. Yeah, so, I mean, the Bible is full of strange and awkward things, especially when you get into the prophetic literature. So when you compare it to all these other weird stuff, it's not that bad, you know. Fits in with all the weirdness. And but how interesting it is, if it's true, that when Jesus rose, he took a bunch of dead people and brought them up with him. Maybe there was such power released on that morning that even the dead people grabbed, you know, got some of it, and their souls were thrust back in their bodies because there is that much power poured out on the earth that, you know, when Jesus rose from the grave. And I have a feeling it's something like that. And then we think, we also have this idea that Jesus went to hell and came back, or he defeated the enemy and brought back some, it's in there somewhere. And so that could kind of go along with it too. Maybe some of those people were some of the people he rescued in hell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they could have been hallucinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other thoughts on this resurrection? The weird stuff like that?
I mean, it's just hanging in there to make our faith, like, an actual, like, faith challenge, like, that, you know, that passage.
I have a theory on that, because I thought of the same thing. It's like, well, maybe because the weird stuff in there causes...
redemption to take place. It causes more focus on, you know, on things so that it actually gets discussed. I don't know.
Well, I think we have to worry about your salvation with fear and trembling. So you can think of it as like a lifelong journey. But it kind of goes back to like what we talked about, this was like months ago already. Sort of like the reliability of, you know, the eyewitness part of the, sorry, I'm really tired and having trouble.
You're talking about the reliability of the manuscripts and how the scribes may have miscopied? That the scribes wrote in.
The fact that they put in difficult things is evidence for the fact that no one was just after the fact making up this religion, because they would have made it nice and perfect and smooth and not had all this weird stuff. So the fact that there's weird stuff is evidence that nobody made it up.
Yeah. This is great. Go ahead. That's very well stated, and I think that's a great point that Christianity provides the seeker, that we're not just a spiritual sort of group of people. You know, we're not looking for a spiritual experience. We're looking for truth. We're looking for how things end. Where did we come from? Who are we? Why are we this way? And Christianity gives answers to the human condition. So that's a great point. I think let's take a little break. She made some brownies, I think homemade. Okay. So we got to do justice to the brownies. But to leave on this thought is that Paul talks about the resurrection power living in us. So as Christians who are going through the process of sanctification, the resurrection continues to matter because we are people that have the resurrection power within us, and we tap into that power. It's the power of the Holy Spirit. The power that raised Jesus from the dead, Paul says, now lives in you. And he says in Philippians 3, I want to know Christ in the power of his resurrection, to share in the fellowship of his sufferings, so that somehow I might attain the resurrection of the dead. And this is an awesome point to finish on, that he essentially did, you know, go to his death, and he attained that power. And he had it the whole way there. It lived in him, just like he preached. So thank God for the resurrection, because it gives hope for us in the future, and it gives hope for us today. All right, so let's take a break, and on that note, have some good brownies. Yes, I'll pass those out. So maybe the lovely Sarah could pass out the new outline for you. And by the way, you're due for a new divider tab in your dividers. I got those dividers at Staples for, I think a pack of like 8 was like $6 or something like that. I can't remember. I may go get some this week, but feel free to just grab some yourself. If I do, it's not going to cost me much more than, because there's not many people left in the last few weeks, so maybe I'll just grab 2 packages of them. But if you could bring $1.50 next week, that'd be great, or just get some dividers yourself. So this will actually go at the back of your binder, in the back side of the resurrection one that we just finished. So when you get your new divider this weekend or next Thursday, you just slip that one between the resurrection stuff and this guy. And what I'd like to do tonight, when talking about archaeology, like I've talked about in the past, when I mentioned archaeology, is that unfortunately, it's not a topic that's regularly talked about in apologetical discussions, and I'm not going to spend a ton of time on it tonight, because there's so much stuff that we've dug up from the earth, and you just can't talk about it in one session or even 2 sessions. You really got to, if you really want to talk about everything there is to know about archaeology, you really just go through every single piece of evidence there is, and in the, you know, hit the big ones. But even then, there's just so many. I have a little show and tell before we get into the outline. These are published by Rose Publishing, and I'm going to pass them around. But what you can do is, if you don't want to get a big book on archaeology by some big scholar like Bruce Metzger, he's not an archaeologist, but he's a famous New Testament scholar, you can get something like this. You can find them, I think, at the Calvary Chapel bookstore over there in Costa Mesa, Santa Ana, in their little bookstore there. I think it's on Sunflower. And you just buy these for like $3 or something. And you can find all this stuff on the web. But this is just handy. You don't have to go to a million different websites, because there are a million different websites on archaeology, especially biblical archaeology. This is by Rose Publishing. It just says 50 Proofs for the Bible. I'll pass it around. And what it has is just a ton of photos, and it has a nice column here, archaeological find, description of the find, and importance of the find. And they smell real good, and they're a lot of fun. So knock yourself out. And honestly, you could read that. It'll take you an hour. No, it's all archaeological finds. And there you go. Oh, you have the same thing.
Old Testament and archaeology.
That's the same thing. You have exactly the same thing with different colors. It's New Testament and Old Testament.
Oh. So they were two
together. Yeah. Yeah. So those are great little deals. And she, it's the same thing. Hers was maybe newer, older, whatever. But they're really cool. And you don't have to go dig around and be like, is this website credible or anything? This is a Christian publishing company. And they're showing you some really good stuff that has been dug up from the earth. So I really recommend something quick and easy like that to whet your appetite. Tonight, and that's what I'm doing tonight, as I'm whetting your appetite. Because I can sit here and show you all of these things, and you'll actually get bored to tears after about 2 hours of this. And literally, you're talking about thousands of years of history of people living, making little pottery pieces and inscribing things on stones and painting hieroglyphics in a cave. You're talking about thousands and thousands of years of this stuff. And there's books that were written way back when, just like Moses wrote books and just like Joshua and all that. There's all this, these books that were written. And, you know, we just have to say, where do we begin? You know, when you open up the can of archaeology, where do you begin? I happened to had the opportunity to go to Israel a couple years ago. And so I'm a certified archaeologist. I never told you this. But when I was there, I dug in the dirt a little bit, and I pulled up a coin from the Roman era and thus proved the existence of God to myself from that coin because it said Caesar on it. I was like, see, the New Testament doesn't lie, Caesar. But you go there and they sell these coins. You can go to like any little tourist shop, especially in Jerusalem, and there's thousands of these little coins in a display case. And they're real coins from the Roman era. It's crazy. Well, at least they say they are. If they're lying, then you can't tell the difference because they're little pieces of awkward silver with, you know, little faces on them, kind of like our coins. But they're not perfect circles. They're kind of like more random shapes. And anyway, it's just a fun place when you go there because it's one of the things I was going to mention is when we were there, Obama was visiting in Egypt. This is right after he was elected or inaugurated. And he was making a speech, his first international speech in Cairo. I don't know if you guys remember this a couple years ago. And he made it at the University of Cairo or something. And we were in Israel. So we were hearing about it in the Israeli papers, like the Jerusalem Post or something. And as I continued to read, it's like big archaeological find. I can't remember the title of the article, but it was like that. But it was like on the back or near the end of the newspaper, like in a place that it made it seem it wasn't a big deal. But it was like something big, you know. And I was like, this is strange. Like, why isn't this on the front page, you know? So this sort of stuff just happens all the time there. They have archaeological finds all over the place all the time. It's been happening there for the last 50 years, 60 years. And so it's a really fascinating place. Archaeology and the discoveries there are just common. But the thing about it is they have so much impact for Christians and Jews alike, but for Christians too. And so if you start your outline here, I'm just going to keep this nice photo up here. Acknowledging and learning archaeology is very important in one study of the available empirical data pointing to the truth-telling nature of the Bible. So when we talked earlier in the class about extra-biblical evidence that confirms what the New Testament authors wrote about, like we had Josephus and other Roman historians, Tacitus, Pliny the Younger, and all these other guys, when we talked about how they say things that also corroborate what the Bible says and it all makes sense and jives together, this is another piece of evidence. All I said at the time, if you look back in your notes, is archaeological evidence is further confirms the reliability of the Old Testament, the New Testament. So what I'm saying here is, look, we can sit here and talk about archaeology for years and hours, but what I'm just going to tell you is make some broad brush statements, whet your appetite a little bit, and point you to some things, and let you kind of go to town on your own. So it's important for apologetics, is what I'm saying here in the first point. It points to the reliability of the Bible. It's extra-biblical evidence that says what the Bible's saying actually corroborates with history. So point B, archaeology is such an important component of our to our Christian apologetics, but it is often overlooked by apologists and evangelists. This is unfortunate because there's little denying the evidence validating the historical basis for our beliefs. Once you pull something out of the ground that points to something that the New Testament says happened, and you like, see, these things match, it makes sense, it's from the same time period, you know these guys were describing and reporting facts of history along with their miracles, it grounds our faith. So it's one thing to claim a history and believe it, but upon investigation, if one finds that history never took place, then one's belief is not grounded. Suppose we say that, a big pterodactyl came in, picked up, Moses and took him to Atlantis, the city, the lost city of Atlantis. Well, that's cool and all, but we can't falsify that claim. We can't verify it and falsify it. So what we're saying here is that it's one thing to claim a history, say this is a history that we believe to be true. But when you actually go investigate it, if you don't pull out any evidence for it, no one's going to believe that history. For instance, consider a fairy tale expressing a sort of a story of somewhere in ancient Europe, for instance. When leprechauns, fairies, dwarfs, smurfs, Beauty and the Beast, or whatever, went around helping each other, praising gods, and teaching each other to live righteous lives, so more fairy dust will come to them, so they will get gold at the end of the rainbow. Okay, suppose someone makes up this story. The leprechauns, the fairies, Beauty and the Beast, they all hang out in ancient Europe in some city, and they live righteous lives so that more fairy dust will come to them, and they'll get the gold at the end of the rainbow. Suppose someone makes that claim. If this is not based in evidence, then all we can know is that it is a good story and not much more can be said. And this is the claim that people are making against Christianity today. It's a good story, but not much more can be said. It's just like the leprechauns, the fairies, they're looking for pixie dust, it helps them live righteous lives, and they get the gold at the end of the rainbow. It's the same thing. So point D, the dirt has already given volumes of evidence and is waiting to give up more and more facts. It is waiting for us to learn about our Christian heritage. The ground literally grounds our belief. Helpful? Helpful for you? The ground literally grounds our belief. Thank God for archaeology. And so many of the keys of our past as Christians have been unlocked by digging up the ground. So thank God for the stuff that's sitting in the ground over there, because it grounds our belief. And it unlocks the keys to our past. So I'm saying here in item F, I'll just tell you, when I was in Israel, we were around on this tour bus with a couple of college students, or former college students from Yale Divinity School. They had got their master's there in something. And they said that part of the requirement to graduate from Yale Divinity School is you have to go spend a summer or two in Israel as an intern, volunteer, digging up some archaeological stuff. So you just join a dig somewhere, and you just help out, and you dig all summer in the heat. And it's terrible. But you're a college student, and you just deal with it. And so Yale Divinity School makes that a requirement because Yale realizes the importance and the power of archaeology and what it does for formulating a historicity of a belief system and grounds it. And so Yale does it. I don't know why other seminaries don't require it. And by the way, I've taken many seminary classes where there's this many students. So if you think this is weird, don't feel so weird. Because a lot of times, especially when you get into the higher levels of your academic career, it's usually a group this size or smaller. And you usually meet like two or three with one professor at a time. And that's your class. So it's real mentoring, if you will. So good thing for you is that I'm a top-notch scholar. So you're getting some good stuff. Yeah. You're like, all right, whatever. What's that? Yeah. So, next page. So far, all events, places. This is the big statement, okay? So far, all events, places, and people that scholars dismissed in the past as fiction have been uncovered and evidenced as fact, confirming the biblical accounts. I don't know why there's a period. It's just continuation. Confirming the biblical accounts. Now, I'm yelling this, okay? There have not been any contradictory archaeological finds or any evidence disproving the biblical accounts. Again, nothing has been dug up that is contradictory to what we find in the scriptures. And every time in the past people have said it has been, it's been overturned later on. And this is a big point. And I'll continue that point kind of at the end. But this is huge. If we find something that says Paul was kidnapped by a pterodactyl and sent to the lost city of Atlantis, and there's some inscription that we uncover in the ground on some stone, you know, it's going to be contrary to the idea that he died in Rome, you know, was martyred by Caesar. So then we can, the critic can easily say, look, obviously one of these things is right. Which one is it? So we have now a questionable account in the book of Acts. And so there it is. Boom. That says, shut up. Time to shut up. So I'm just going to finish this a little bit. We'll end in about 10 minutes. Is that okay? Okay. So item two. The big thing here, archaeological evidence for the Old Testament, and then we're going to look at archaeological evidence for the New Testament. So archaeological finds confirm historical people, occurrences, and places, not to mention Hebrew, Egyptian, Assyrian, and Babylonian cultures and histories, the authors of the Old Testament wrote about. So we have confirmation through archaeology of everything the Old Testament said, not to mention all the other cultures around at the time. We have the flood, which has multiple attestation by over 30 other cultures. So now the 30 other cultures don't say Noah had an ark and the animals went two by two and they were happy and then the dove came and then the waters receded and it's on Mount Ararat. Well, they don't say that. They call him maybe another name. I think maybe Gilgamesh is another word. And I think the Babylonian Chronicles describe Gilgamesh in a flood. In a boat, or something of that nature. So there's 30 other cultures that have reports or some sort of, maybe even fictitious sorts of tales that were told describing this ancient event with a flood and a guy and a boat. And so you have multiple attestation, okay, of the flood. The Dead Sea Scrolls, a la photo, greatest find perhaps in archaeology, I would say for Bible people, maybe not for non-Christians, but for Christians, this is perhaps the greatest find that we have is this one. And we all know about the Dead Sea Scrolls, so I'm not going to go into that too much detail. Now, this is what I wanted to show you. Sodom and Gomorrah recently found how much did I go into it? Just... Okay, because I want to bore you to tears right now. So I'm going to go into it in detail, and you're going to hate me for it. I'm just kidding. What I'm going to show you is something really interesting. It's a photo of me and Sarah. Hey! Okay. okay, now I'm going to show you this. Don't look at my file structure, because you'll steal my stuff later on. Don't judge me. Stop it. You're doing it. I know you are. Okay. The Sodom and Gomorrah was always thought to be on the south west side or southeast side of the Dead Sea. Okay, so think Jerusalem over here, the big fat Dead Sea, and up above is the Sea of Galilee, right? So Jordan, the nation of Jordan, is on the other side of the Dead Sea. And just to give you an idea of these things. So... So on this side is Jordan, the nation of Jordan, and Syria is like up there, right, where they're killing their people. So this is Jordan, and over here is Israel. Okay? And this is where the Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea. Okay? Now, Sodom and Gomorrah was always thought to be down here towards this side of the Dead Sea. And again, Jerusalem is like over here somewhere. And then the Sea of Galilee is up here. So everyone always thought it was over here until Dr. Stephen Collins, archaeologist, and this is like kind of groundbreaking news, and I'm giving it to you free of charge. And what happens is the water flows. Okay, isn't that exciting? And then you have a kind of a geographic situation here like that that creates what's known as the disk, okay? So the disk of the Jordan. So Dr. Stephen Collins says that there's something intriguing about this geographical region that's intriguingly similar to what the Bible describes when it describes the geography of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so he spent 10 years researching this, and he says, you know, I think Sodom and Gomorrah is up here. And so you see Jerusalem over here, just to give you an idea where this is at. And by the way, to get to, we took a road trip like this, and it is like, you, when you go to the Mojave Desert, when you go up to Barstow and pass to Vegas and Arizona, it's like that. It's like barren wasteland nastiness. You just don't want to go there. It sucks. So we're just on the boat, I mean on the bus, and we're cruising down, I mean air-conditioned bus, thank God, but it's like 120 out there. It's just nasty stuff everywhere. And so when you hear wilderness in the Bible, it was more like desert wasteland when you hear the, you know, Israelites going through the wilderness. It was more like the road to Barstow, if you will, or Phoenix, whatever. So Dr. Stephen Collins, there's Jericho, by the way. One, or both Jerichos are there. You can look into why there's both later. And here's Tell El Hammam. Tell El Hammam is what he says is the place of ancient Sodom and Gomorrah. And he says it's there because the geography matches the description in the Bible. And so he set out, after 10 years of researching this, to do an archaeological dig. He's an archaeologist. And just to give you an idea, there's other, what are listed here as talls, but when you're in Israel, they just call them tell whatever, like Tell Megiddo, Megiddo being the place where Armageddon happens. A tell is just kind of a hill, and on the top, they built a little city. So like, there's all these tells everywhere, but they just mean hill and then in the name of the city. And here he's calling them tall. Maybe that's an Arabic way to say it. But it's the same idea, just a little hill, and there's the name of the city. And so he's saying that there's all these little cities around here, but Tell El Hammam is kind of the biggest, and this is what is kind of described in the Bible. It's a big area. So there's like a, this is a current view. So you see down here in this region, these are a couple tells. So, I mean, this is a high mountain we're on right here. So these are would be the hills where Sodom and Gomorrah would be on. And he's now showing what it would look like back in that time and how you would have both cities on top of the hills. And this is kind of the extent of it. And that's kind of the end. So the point of this is just to show you that this stuff is happening all the time, and it's intriguing, the finds he has there. I was going to give you a clip, actually. It may take me a little while to find, of him describing this. We interviewed him, our team, apologetics.com team, and put it on our website. So you can check out the interview there. And he's just very soft-spoken, kind of down-to-earth guy. But this is a major, major find here, because what he found is that not only is it exactly like, he says it's Sodom and Gomorrah for sure. There's no question. Like, he found it. And, you know, scholars debate about these things, but it's basically undeniable is what he's saying. And he said that what he found there was certain ash samples he took from the ground that suggest a fiery event took place, and he suggests that it came down in such a way, there was some fire from the sky, essentially, that came down in a certain place to the point where he found bodies, skeletons, kind of positioned away from this central, you know, spot. And the bodies appeared to have been thrown violently, as he put it, because of the way that bones were resting in the ground, almost to the point where they were displaced or awkwardly positioned to where it was almost like an explosion of some sort took place to displace the skeletal remains, suggesting that a kind of a bomb went off and something exploded and people ran or were thrown and then fried, essentially, burned alive. And he's able to test the soil samples and things like that to confirm that it was a fire of some sort. So, you know, this obviously corroborates with the miraculous story of the fire coming down from heaven. Interesting? Okay. So, I'm not going to obviously talk about all of these, but I've given you a list of some really intriguing finds, and of course, like these things that I passed around suggest, is that there's hundreds more, and these aren't even, I think, listed in those little pamphlets. So we're just going to look at these, and you can just kind of see that you have stuff from 3500 BC all the way down to, you know, close to the New Testament, 500 BC, that I've just listed here, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff too. And again, all of these things confirm cultural rituals, they confirm things that the Bible talks about, like geographic places or rulers of some sort in some region or city, some sort of maybe trade routes. You know, all of these things confirm what the Bible's talking about. Not necessarily miracles, but we're talking about just general historical stuff. So item 3, archaeology of the New Testament, or archaeological evidence of the New Testament. And the same idea here is that archaeological finds confirm historical people, occurrences in places, and other cultures of that the New Testament authors wrote about. So people, I do want to just kind of cruise through a couple of these, and then I'll make a couple other statements and we'll close. The first century plaque with the inscription Tiberium Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judah, was found in Caesarea Maritima. So I've been there, and it's this really cool port area, and it was built for Caesar by Herod, and it's this really nice place. They have like a whole Olympic kind of racetrack where they used to race the horses, and it's right there by the Mediterranean Ocean. Like literally, it's like being at Huntington Beach, the big kind of big wide sand beach. It's like that, and they have kind of castles and stuff that the Crusaders later attached to the structures, and the harbor goes out into the port. Now, it was debated that there was no such place, or this port wasn't that big as, like, Josephus once described. So scholars, you know, they attack Josephus too, because Josephus says it was a huge port, but it really wasn't that big when archaeologists first came across it. And Josephus says it's similar to the port Piraeus at Athens. So Athens is kind of a coastal town like L.A. It's not right on the coast, but there's a port, like Port of Long Beach, if you will, called Piraeus. And Sarah and I actually went there. And so Josephus says this port is just like as big as that port. And scholar says, no, Josephus, you got it all wrong. It's kind of a small port. But later on, they went under the water, and they uncovered all these remains that were within the water, actually, and it turns out that the port extended into what's now covered by the ocean. And so they further confirmed even Josephus's account. But what was found there was a plaque with the inscription Tiberium Pontius Pilate. A lot of scholars in the past debated the existence of Pontius Pilate, that the New Testament authors just made him up because there's no other reports of him anywhere. So to find something like this, it's just like in your face. You know, they dig up the ground and here it is, and it's like in your face, Pontius Pilate existed, is basically what it's saying. And this is just an interesting thing. Like, another thing was, there's a sign at some city, I can't remember the name, and it's like, welcome to such and such city, you know, kind of like what we have. And nothing like that exists. And so they used to think that that city didn't exist, and now they found that sign there. It's like, okay, the city exists. They thought the same thing about Nazareth, by the way, that Jesus, again, made up stuff, that Nazareth wasn't a real place. Because it's not listed anywhere in any other ancient historical document until like the 4th or 7th century or something. But what we have found is a bunch of bones that are dug up in the region around Nazareth that suggest there's people living there in the 1st century. And then recently, I think after 1940-ish or something, they found a bunch of underground grottos, I think, I mentioned to you in the past, and now they have built the Church of the Nazarene on top of it, which is the structure spanning over what was thought to be old houses that are basically dug into the ground, which some people say Jesus lived in some sort of underground chamber. So again, all this stuff is really interesting because it is really applicable and relevant. And so here's mention of this guy, Galileo, a proconsul in Greece that was found. The burial ossuaries that have been found. Item 4, the ossuary for James, the brother of Jesus, which is debated. It reads, James, the son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. So you have some really cool finds like this. Now, it may or may not be true, but, you know, this sure looks like James, the brother of Jesus' bones and his bone box, essentially, is what ossuary is. As Zeus and Hermes, inscriptions at Lystra, which supports the account where Paul, if you remember, Paul and Barnabas went into Lystra. I think this is where Paul got thrown out. And the people of the Greek city Lystra thought that they were Zeus and Hermes because they're so well-spoken. And so they said, you're Zeus and Hermes in the human flesh. And they bowed down to worship Paul and Barnabas, if you recall. And they said, no, men of Lystra, do not worship us. We do not deserve such honor. We had come here representing Jesus Christ, blah, 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 blah. And then once they kept preaching and the people of Lystra kind of got tired of them, especially after there was an accuser that came up and sparked controversy, I think the people of Lystra threw Paul and Barnabas out. I think that's where Paul went back into the city and preached again. So here again, we find inscriptions in Lystra about Zeus and Hermes, suggesting that the Acts account makes sense because the people liked Zeus and Hermes in that area. So here's a few other things. We have crucifixion victims, bones found at that time, item 7. And then you have a labeled crucifixion victim, Yohanan ben Hagalgal, which is like John from that city, was discovered. And it showed the signs of supporting the crucifixion account found in the Gospels with 7-inch spikes through the feet and lower arm. So we see victims crucified just like Jesus was described to be crucified. And item 9 is both of his legs were broken, just like what's talked about where they usually break the legs of the people on the cross. Next page is the occurrences, and then we have places, and then I'll finish up here. You have plaques with these people suggesting that there was a census by Caesar when during the time of Herod, when he said everyone returned to their hometown to take a census, and then Herod issued the command to kill all the babies born in Bethlehem. And then Joseph and Mary fled because the angel told them about that. So they were in Bethlehem, but they fled to Egypt with Jesus. And so this plaque confirms that there was a census like it was described in the Bible. And this is interesting, Emperor Claudius' Nazareth decree. Well, between AD 41 and 54, this decree threatens tomb raiders with death. This may have been issued because of the outbreak of rumors of Jesus' resurrection. So the government authorities said, okay, if you're caught raiding a tomb, you're going to die. And they may have done this because the disciples started saying that Jesus rose from the grave. And so again, it corroborates. You have a bunch of coins, all these things that were talked about. Those are found, and they corroborate with the New Testament. The places you have the pavement that Jesus was supposedly before Pontius Pilate, that was found, Gabbatha, the pavement. And so that's probably what Pilate's praetorium was. That was found. And the Megiddo church was found. And basically, I'll just tell you what that says is they uncover these churches, and when they uncover them, they find a tile arrangement on the floor of the church. And the church is no bigger than half the size of this room. So it's very small. And you, as you dig, you find a mosaic of tiles like this big. And they're not perfect squares like in our bathrooms, but they're just kind of random little pieces. But they're colored, and they retain their color because that's the color of the rock. So it's just a rock. And so it creates this nice arrangement and pattern. And usually it kind of has a story, like maybe a fish over here and like a light and a cloud and a dove and stuff like that. And it's pointing to like, I don't know, something. And so you have these arrangements of tiles, and they're on the floor of these churches. And the fish is most commonly found at these places. This guy said that he, if you look halfway down the quote, the God-loving Ekatos has offered this table to the God Jesus Christ as a memorial. Gainas, Roman military officer, having sought honor from his own money, made the mosaic. So it's interesting because when you find these things in the inscriptions in the floor mosaics of these churches, you find little things like this was purchased by this person and dedicated it for this reason, and they say the God Jesus Christ. So the God Jesus Christ. So we find confirming evidence that the early church considered Jesus Christ as God outside of the Bible. So other people and other extra-biblical evidence say that the early church thought Jesus was God. And the other interesting thing about this, you can turn the page, I just made point one. Point two is that Christianity was well established in Israel in the first century, which is when that church was said to be in existence. And three, the Christianity appealed to various classes of society, the rich, the poor, and military people, Romans, and all different sorts of people, which is exactly what we know from the Bible. Paul talks about the rich and the poor and different sorts of people in society becoming Christians. So again, it confirms the Bible. Now, I'm not going to read through this, but I'll tell you something very interesting. When I was there, our tour guide was Jewish, and apparently we were on the Christian heritage tour, but it was more like the Jewish cultural tour, and he wasn't a Christian, and kind of an atheist Jew, and kind of looks like Bob, I think, too. And anyway, as he's going on and on the tour, we did go to churches, and he was saying that Helena, if you recall, was Constantine's mother. Constantine was an emperor in Rome that moved the capital from Rome to Constantinople, which is now modern-day Istanbul. His mother was sympathetic to Christians, and I think already a Christian before Constantine converted, and he was the first Roman emperor to convert, and basically changing the entire social structure of the whole Roman Empire. And so Helena, his mom, went to Israel after he converted to kind of establish an institute, if you will, some of the historical places that Christians, you know, thought the miracles occurred at, like Bethsaida, Capernaum, Nazareth, all these places. So she went around and she kind of venerated, like we talked about, and enshrined some of these places, and then basically started a church there, kind of built a church building, again, which was a very small, humble sort of thing. And in doing so, she brought money for the construction and the church mosaics. And this was actually the fourth century. So this is around 325 AD. So a few hundred years after the early church was started. And so what she did was that some of these churches had already been destroyed and withered from the first century. And so she built a new mosaic on top of it. So when you walk in there, you see kind of the remains of the 4th century mosaic, and then they'll have like a window looking downward to the remains of the 1st century mosaic. So you're literally on top of something that was 400 and then looking down to something that was from AD like 50 or something. So it's really cool because you're like in the same church that the disciples may have been in themselves. So it's really fascinating. And the cool thing is the mosaic continues the same pattern from the old to the new. So where the old kind of was decaying, the new one continues. It's really sweet. And Helena did this, and that's what I'm saying right there. And then you have a bunch of other things I'm saying on page 17, and people think that they found the place exactly where Golgotha, where Jesus was crucified, and the garden tomb where Jesus rose from the dead, and other things like the Siloam pool, the foundations of Herod's temple that Jesus has visited during his trips to the Jerusalem. And so these miracles are reported alongside the you know, like Luke says, Governor such and such was in his third year, and Jesus went to Galilee, and he performed many miracles there. It's kind of all in the same chunk of text. So it lends credibility to the miracle being historical, because the event that was just described in the sentence before is historical, and archaeology confirms that. So we can see that from one sentence to another, it's really hard to say that the disciples were lying when Jesus did a miracle there. It makes sense that they weren't lying the entire time, not that they were lying about the miracles and telling the truth about the governor being in power. And so that's what I'm saying here on point 9 on page 7. And point 10, this points to the historical nature of the entire written work. And these help show the skeptic that the genre or truth-telling nature of the authors is not modified from one verse to the next, which is what I was just saying. So we'll close with that. And I have a list here of other places that I went to and there and other confirming places. And again, as you can see from these things, and if you just go on the internet, I mean, there's tons of websites on biblical archaeology. So any questions? Yeah. It was a few years ago. Now I had been graduated already for a while. Yeah, I just decided to go with my little brother and kind of explore. Yeah.
So was it like an organized thing?
No, we just were like, hey, let's go find a tour guide and went. So Sarah's. She really wanted to go, and I actually never thought I would go there, but Kev, my little brother, was really excited about it, and he needed a vacation and stuff, and he thought, this is a great time to do it. I found this really cheap tour, and so I was like, all right, I'll do it. And I went with them, and it's super impactful. Like, it's just as all these trips that go, you hear churches going and stuff all the time, it really is impactful. It really is to be there. And you're like, Jesus may have walked here, you know? Paul may have walked here. It's really trippy to think that. And it really... it wasn't the same without her, though. But it's like you're going back in time, and it really, again, adds this sense that what we believe was not fairy tales, but there are actual people walking in actual places. And the last point I was going to make is that you contrast this with... the Book of Mormon, and I'll tell you this last thing. Yes. That's the point I was going to make. So basically, I read half of the Book of Mormon, and it's pretty big, and when you're reading it, he's talking about these historical places like around the time of Abraham, I think, and then the offspring were these sorts of people. Yeah, and And he goes on to tell these real intricate, detailed stories. And it's just like, oh, man, it sounds like you were there, like, you know, writing it all down. But he wasn't. You know, it was given to him by the angel in the forest in America a couple hundred years ago. So, well, the angel apparently was very detailed when the angel wrote it down or whatever. And so I'm reading this Book of Mormon, and I'm like, this is so amazing to me that this guy wrote the stuff, because Joseph Smith actually wrote it, right? So he wrote this stuff with the intention on describing a history that never took place. And then what happens is they leave Israel and go on boats to America, and then the rest of the Book of Mormon happens in America. And it's mind-boggling, the deception that is going on here with this book, because he writes it in a style and manner that's very similar to how the Old Testament is written. It almost sounds like it as if Moses wrote it because of the type of wording that is happening. And it's just like it's intentional that he was writing a believable account in a manner that was very believable and like the Old Testament, so that people would believe it to be true. And it wasn't like, oh, he just thought he'd write this stuff down like a journal and think he'd, you know, be for himself. He wrote it because he knew other people would latch onto it. And so the level of deception in Joseph Smith is mind-boggling. And you just get so mad when you're reading this, because you're just like, are you kidding me? And then story after story and account after account. And it sounds exactly like the Book of Genesis. Like, these people went over here, somebody laid with somebody, a child was born, a war broke out. I mean, it's just like, what? And it's all a lie. It never took place. And I was going to read a quote. It's in the car. But basically, there's no confirming evidence, no archaeological evidence of anything in the Book of Mormon. Like, secular and Christian scholars both say this: there's nothing that has ever been brought up out of the earth that actually confirms this account took place here in the Americas or in Israel, or that these people ever lived, or that there was such and such a temple. There's nothing like that. There's no archaeological evidence. So it's pretty amazing that to be a Mormon, you have to believe in something which there's no evidence for in the archaeological sense, and believe this book was not a lie by Joseph Smith, and that he actually recorded things as the angel told him or gave him. It's quite a fascinating set of doctrines to accept. And that's the basis of their belief system. And so, and when you read it, it's just this full account. All this history, all this stuff. Jesus appears a couple times in the Americas to the people, and it's really, really frustrating to read it. So contrast that with us, where we have volumes of stuff. I mean, this hundreds and thousands of pieces of evidence confirming thousands of years of history. And you can be assured as a Christian that your faith rests on solid ground, no pun intended. Okay, so last thoughts on that? Sorry to throw that last part in, but I had to. Last thoughts, comments? Okay. Would someone like to close us in prayer? Thanks, Veronica. That's very sweet of you. You don't have to. Someone. Yes. Okay. Anybody else? Princess?
Okay.
Thank you, everybody, for coming and hanging in this late. Have a great week. See you next time.